This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
For years, I was so fed up with shampoo, I just stopped washing my hair. I quit completely. I was so sick of poofy, frizzy, limp hair, distorting my natural oils. Until a few months ago, I found Modern Mammals, and it changed everything. And by the way, right now you can visit modernmammals.com and use code LSS for 10% off. So check that out. So look, I heard about this through the podcast, and before I agreed to advertise, they sent it to me and I was reluctant. But let me tell you, I should not have been. This stuff is absolutely magical. My hair felt better, smelled way better, and most importantly, looked better. And I know it will do the same for you as well. It doesn't have those hair-ruining chemicals like other products, and it doesn't leave any leftover residues. It works. Don't believe me? Go read their awesome reviews online as well. Go to modernmammals.com and use code LSS for 10% off. Again, that's modernmammals.com for 10% off with promo code LSS. Don't forget to use our promo code LSS so they know we sent you. Hello and welcome, everybody. A little bit of exciting news slash information before we jump in. This week and next week, we're doing what I'm calling the two-part Under Oath mini-series. So today we have Spencer. Next week we have Aaron. It's going to be so awesome. So make sure you're subscribed. That way next week, boom, you'll be all caught up with everything Under Oath. Now here we go. Welcome to Lead Singer Syndrome. This is Shane and only Shane. I'm waiting for Spencer from Under Oath to call me, and he's 14 minutes late right now. I'm looking at my phone. I got this all set up on the laptop, just waiting for him to call. So maybe it'll happen. But hey, enough about that. I'm doing good. Thanks for asking. Yeah, I'm having a great day. Actually, a quick story. I got stuck trying to go to Pittsburgh to see Brian Fallon from Gaslight. He was doing a solo show down there, and I'm friends with him and a couple guys from his crew, and wanted to go down and hang out. So my girlfriend and I got in the car, and we got to, well, I guess it's Westfield, New York, if anyone knows where that is, about halfway between Buffalo and Erie. Pennsylvania, and it got fucking crazy. We had to stop, pulled over in Westfield, New York, which is, I mean, it's one of those cities, you know, if you blink, you'll miss it. We ended up going to a CVS. We bought a chessboard, and we had a very, very quiet night at the theater motel. Thank you to the lovely staff of one at the theater motel for your hospitality. But I'm back now in Toronto, and everything's great with me, and I'm just waiting for Spencer to give me a little ring here. I guess this is the real lead singer syndrome coming through here, you know? Being a rock star, being late. We'll see if he's got some kind of story. But anyways, while I have you guys here, I got to tell you about my new solo project. It is out now. I have an EP out on Rise Records and New Damage in Canada. It is just three songs, but you can order the 7-inch online. It's also on iTunes, Spotify, all that stuff. It's called River Oaks, and I played all the instruments myself, even the drums, which, you know, I guess I can hold my own, but, you know, I've never played drums in a band, like, for realsies, you know? So it was tough, but it was a challenge that I welcome. So please check out the EP, self-titled, River Oaks, riveroaksmusic.com. Other stuff, if you want to support the show, it's real easy. All we're asking for right now is if you buy anything off Amazon, use this link, leadsingersyndrome.com/Amazon. That takes you right to the Amazon homepage. You log in as usual, and we get 4% of whatever you buy, and it costs you absolutely nothing. So it's real easy. If you go and you buy some, I don't know, some condoms or something, hey, we get 4%. It's perfect. And what else? If you want to get in touch, if you like the show, if you got suggestions, of course, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. I love to hear from you. We also have the hate line, 657-666-HATE, hate. That's what you need to call if you're not so happy. And I know I keep saying we're going to roll clips. It is coming. It is coming. We will roll clips. I got some funny ones. I can't wait to play those for you guys. All right. I'm still here waiting. Spencer hasn't called me yet. He's now 30 minutes late, but it's cool. You know, I'm just hanging out. You know, I got some work to do. It's good. I think this is going to be a good interview, but now that he's late, I'm going to really have to grill him, I think, on some stuff. I'm going to really have to ask him those tough questions he might not want to answer. That might be his punishment. It's now 3:41. He's 40 minutes late. This is really turning into some rock star shit. I love it. I love it. I can't wait to give him a hard time about this. Still waiting on Mr. Chamberlain. And I really want to know what's the story is here. What's going on? Let's see if he gives me a ring or if we're going to have to reschedule this. Oh, I think this is him. Hello?
Hey, dude. What's up, man?
Hey, man. There you are.
Dude, totally blew that one.
What happened?
I thought you said 4 for some reason. I don't know why I had that in my head. I remember telling my brother, I'm visiting my brother right now.
Yeah.
He has a 4 o'clock conference call. I was like, oh, cool. Yeah. I got a call at 4 o'clock too.
It's one of those things, man, where you just see the number and then in your head, it's one thing and on paper, it's another.
Yeah. I don't know what,
and you know what,
thinking.
Man, I'm just glad it wasn't me. Cause it's like, it's always me. I'm the guy that's like, I'm late for everything. You know, like I used to be in a band, like when I was younger, and everybody in the band would tell me like an hour earlier than everyone else, so I'd be on time. You know,
yeah, totally.
That's me. So, are you good to do this? I don't want to, because I know sometimes it's like you had your day planned, and I'm like, don't want to mess it up anymore than I already am.
I'm literally chilling. I'm leaving tomorrow to go home, so I'm literally just kind of chilling, hanging out. He's working from home right now, so he's busy, and I'm just kind of chilling with family, you know. So
good. Whereabouts exactly?
Most of my family's in North Carolina, and that's like where I'm originally from.
Yeah.
So I'm in Raleigh. I don't know if you've ever been there.
Oh yeah, Lincoln Theater.
Lincoln Theater. Yeah.
That's the place I know best in Raleigh. Yeah. You know how it is when you're touring, you see like you
the
think
venue,
you know a city.
It.
Like I think I know Atlanta. No. I know the Masquerade.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I don't know anything else about that city really. That's cool, man. So are you guys gearing up for this very big Under Oath tour. When does that start?
Dude.
Soon, right?
The first show is March 16th.
So and, have you guys started like getting together, practicing, all that?
No, everyone's doing their, you know, we've all been living our own lives for the last 3+ years. So everyone's doing all their own, you know, sit with a guitar, make sure you know all the vocals, and Aaron's got his little studio set up in Salt Lake City to where he's going over all the drum stuff, and hopefully the guys like Tim and Grant and James, who haven't played a show since the last show, hopefully they're playing their instruments, you know, on their spare time. But we start meeting up in February. So
I love in your DVD that you put out, the Tired Violence DVD, at the end, how you're just literally throwing your gear into the crowd.
Yeah.
Just like, just won't be needing this anymore. Like, this is the end. So here, take, seeing the slow motion of Chris's like mixer
gear,
or whatever flying through the air.
He
was
to buy all new stuff. He has nothing. Grant has nothing.
Yeah.
Tim still has some gear, I'm pretty sure. I don't think James has any gear.
Right.
I have everything because I've been on tour since the last show. So
seeing that DVD and I just watched it recently. You know, I hadn't thought about you guys, you know, in a long time, really. You know, like we were friends so long ago.
Yeah.
And you know, some of the first memories I have of you guys, like, you know, from like 2004, like when we did Warped Tour that first time, and then
and all the off day shows we did.
Yeah,
we
exactly.
filmed almost every single day on that Warped Tour.
That's right. Yeah. And we did all that together, and then seeing you guys like talking on the bus, and like Russ was there, you know, like your first tour manager, Russ.
Yep.
And seeing you guys all together, it was like really heartwarming to watch it. And I'm almost glad that I watched it now, as opposed to if you guys had put it out in 2013, because I think it really would have hurt me a lot more. But I'm watching the DVD already knowing you're getting back together.
So, yeah, that's a huge difference.
Yeah.
I think the crazy thing about that DVD that a lot of people don't know is, to me, it's half the reason why the band got back together, because why it took so long to come out, because the company who agreed to do the DVD ended up folding as a business and disintegrating, and left us with an unfinished product. So after a year of this thing, was supposed to come out 6 months after the last show. Like, this was supposed to be the parting gift for the fans. Like, it was going to be like, yo, we didn't play everywhere we know, but here there's this rad movie coming out that's pretty damn honest and transparent about what's going on. And it just stopped. And after, I think we hit like a year, it was kind of like, okay. So Tim reaches out because someone contacted him about, this isn't going to come out. And I think that is where the band goes, okay, well, now we need to start talking and communicating. So there's email chains going around with everyone on them. Yeah. And then before you know it, we're communicating again. And I think that brought us kind of back together, like coming up with ideas of how to finish this and who's involved with what. And, you know, we started talking and remembering why we did it in the first place. Is because we're all friends and we all love each other. And I think, honestly, I mean, there's many reasons why we got back together, but I think one of the main lit the fire was, honestly, that DVD not coming out, because we had to start talking. And once you realize what's going on and how, you know, you start missing each other, and I'm sure which would have happened anyway, but that really sparked the fire in our communication again.
But that must have been so funny, because you start talking about putting out this DVD of breaking up, and then by the time it's actually out, were you guys already in talks about getting back together for real?
We joked about it. We joked about, like, I remember someone, I think I want to say it was Grant, goes, let's play a show. You know, Chasing Safety is turning 10, and this was 2014.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were all like, dude, that would be so fun, because I think what's really huge about this is, not to toot our own horns, but Underoath is a band that's big enough that that doesn't need to tour full time. I think we can all agree that a lot of these bands like Incubus or Deftones, you know, they're not on tour all the time. Like, our scene, we were taught to tour 10, 11 months out of the year. And I think Underoath was still doing that throughout its prime and through the entire end. It was like, if you're sitting, you're losing money. The way our business was structured was you tour 24/7. And I think as people get older and become men and have wives and families and, you know, real life stuff happening, that becomes, you pick one or the other. And I picked music, and those dudes picked having kids and families, which is completely fine. But I think getting to the realization of where it's like, wow, now that we took two steps back and we're moving a step forward, you look at it as, you know, this band doesn't have to be 10 months on tour a year to stay afloat. We've been proven, you know, by our fans, which is the other big reason why I think the band got back together, is because Underoath's fan base never faded since the last day. There's still as many, you know, tweets and Facebook mentions or whatever you want to talk about Underoath from the day we broke up all the way until the day before we announced getting back together. It never faded. Like, those people were die hard. And I think it's cool to realize they're like, you know, that band is who it's going to be. And it's going to be the caliber of who it reaches. And that's the fan base. So most of the time when you're touring is you're trying to reach a new fan base. You're trying to gain more fans and more followers. And I think Underoath is what it's going to be. And you can tour once a year and keep your fans happy and put out a record whenever it's ready and not be so like in the grind all the
time. Absolutely.
And I think that's where we're at. And that's really awesome, because it took the pressure off everyone. And now we can all remember why we did this in the first place, that we do love each other, that we are friends. It's about the music. And it's not like about, we're not grinding to where you forget, you know, half the time why you're even up there.
That's
you know?
And that's, you really hit the nail on the head with that last point. But I mean, when you watch the DVD, and I like referencing this just because it really paints this picture of your final moments as a band. And I mean, you're just basically coming right out with it, like saying, I don't want to stop. Like, I want to play, like, I want to play 40 more shows. And if we're going to break up, I want to at least go everywhere one more time. And you're like, I mean, you said some things like, you know, I'm not going to try to live some normal life now, I think was like a direct quote. You're like, this is all I know. And I've been honing my craft for 10 years and this is me. And honestly, like I looked at it and I thought about you guys. And I remember back in when we were touring together, like, I mean, and Silverstein, we go hard too, and we've gone hard and we haven't really stopped, but we take a few breaks. Like, you guys never took any breaks.
Yeah.
And I think honestly, like I, you know, you look into somebody like Tim, especially like just he's doing all the stuff on the business side. He was just tired.
Yeah.
You know, and he just missed his family and wanted to go home and couldn't understand that how much it meant to him because he was right there immersed in it. And I think it would have been too difficult for you guys to just say, okay, well, we're not going to do Under Oath how we know it. And we've done it for like 9-10 years. We're going to do it just once in a while. And then it's
I think that would have been equally shocking because that didn't make sense in our heads because we left like you guys, like I was 18 years old, you know, and it's like you don't understand. Like I've been in band since I was in literally, I think I played my first, I've said this in many interviews before, and my first sold out show, I was in a band with my older brother and his friends. And the first time we played a show that was sold out, I think it was 12 years old. I was a guitar player.
Crazy.
And I was like, you know, and it wasn't huge. It was like a 200 cap little venue in my hometown or whatever. But you know, the first time, you know, Under Oath isn't the first band I've been in. I've been in bands my entire life, probably been in, you know, 20 or 30 bands. And when it finally does click and happen, and you're like, well, obviously at the time, this music wasn't on the radio like it is now. It wasn't on late night TV like it is now. It wasn't popular like it is now. Like, to me, screaming has become mainstream kind of, and it wasn't. So when something clicks, when you're doing something different, and you got to go, well, it's got to be because of our work ethic. It's got to be because we play 300 and something shows a year. And that's got to be why this is working. So in your head, it doesn't make sense to do it any other way until you take 10 steps back maybe. And I think it is definitely what needed to happen. And it was a hard journey that the next couple of years of my life were very tough after the breakup.
Well, the other thing too is like the way you guys had been existing, it's like, all Under Oath. We're putting all of our all into this band 100% of the time, you know? And then it's like, okay, when we decide we don't want to do that anymore, then everyone else decides because they've lived that way for so long, well, we have to put our all into whatever we're going to do next.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a big reason why it just wasn't feasible at that point, at least, for you guys to be an off and on band.
Yeah, absolutely. So I agree with you 100%. I think another huge thing is like, what I said earlier, when we met, I was probably 19 when I met you and we were touring. And I think what's huge is that when you do start a band and, you know, maybe probably a lot of your listeners on this podcast are probably musicians or in bands and they might be younger. You don't realize that a lot of times bands start because you're all pretty similar. You're all in the same music. You're all in the same thing. And you know, you start touring, you get into a van together in your late teens or whatever, fresh out of high school, you're all kind of the same dude, give or take a face and some personality traits. You're all like kind of on the exact same team. And then life starts to happen. If you stay on the road, you know, in your 20s, you kind of start becoming a man and you become different from your bandmates. A lot of you become individuals because different things shape your life, be it, you know, family, you know, girlfriend, or maybe you lost a sibling or a parent or a loved one.
Sure.
You know, like different things happen in your life that will change you completely. And then all of a sudden you've gone through some different things as your late teen friends that you're in a band with, and you realize that you aren't the same person. And for a band like Under Oath, that was very, very, very hard to accept each other's differences. Because at first we were a Christian band at the beginning, and that changed as people grew up and started to believe in different things. And people, we were all like, it was like a little fraternity. We were all like the same kind of dude with the same personality competing with each other. And then real life happened, and we're all these individuals that have struggled with different things, and no one can accept each other for these differences. And what's great about now is coming back to the band is we're all men. that have established our own lives and individuality, and now we can accept each other. It's like, you know what, Tim, you might be one of my best friends, and me and you can sit down in a room with two guitars, write the best, you know, heavy music ever, like we always have, but I can accept that we're cut from a different cloth and we have a lot of differences. We're completely different humans.
Like, right.
You do a lot of things that I wouldn't do and vice versa. And that's okay. Yeah.
And that's okay.
It didn't used to be, you know?
The amazing thing is that like the whole core of acceptance and acceptance of people like your brothers, you know, that's such a core Christian belief.
Yeah.
So to not have that is, you know, I always thought that part was weird about the sort of conformity that a lot of time goes into, you know, into religion and all that. But I mean, what you're speaking and what you're saying is so true because, I mean, when I really got to know you guys was back in 2005, we embarked on both Silverstein and Under Oath's first overseas experience.
Yes.
And we shared a bus. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. I will never forget that.
I'll never forget that. We had three bands on one 18 bunk bus. We toured the UK. We had 21 people actually, and the bus only slept 18. Oh man, it was.
Yeah,
crazy.
We had some couch dwellers. Yeah,
we had. Yeah, and what I remember most about you guys is you guys were like. Yeah, you know, I mean, everyone knew you were a Christian band, but we toured with other Christian bands that were like, you know, I don't know what like non-Christian. I don't even know what that means, but like, you guys were legit. You guys were like so legit. You guys, there was no drinking, there was no swearing, definitely no women. You know,
there was no drinking. I think there might have been some. I don't know. Maybe
no,
not,
you know, the only person that drank, at least like openly, was Ronnie, your sound guy.
Yeah,
and maybe
we weren't. I guess I was 21 at the time. I don't know.
I mean, I do know. I don't know. I mean, maybe.
I know there was some light casual drinking through the entire tour, the entirety of the band for some guys, and some guys didn't start drinking till later. And I'm pretty sure everyone, yeah, within a couple of years, everyone was, you know, if you were of age, you drank. But, you know, nothing crazy, I don't think. But. Yeah, I think at the beginning it was definitely a lot different.
I mean, you guys had Bible study, you know, like Russ was leading Bible study.
Yeah.
I remember one time Grant's Bible fell from the top bunk, like through, you know, the side of the bunk and hit Neil in the head while he was sleeping.
Wow.
So, yeah. I just remember you guys being like super, super legit Christian and people kind of – even asking me like, oh, are those guys like really as, I was like, yeah, they don't swear around me. Like I heard Tim say crap once and that was like the worst thing I've ever heard any of them say to fast forward to the end where you're basically like, you know, you're swearing on your DVD. Like you don't, you know, and that's
no
okay
one really.
Too. Like, you know, you grew as a person, but it's just an observation that I made and knowing you guys for so long that I found interesting.
Yeah, I think for a lot of kids that's difficult to understand when a band puts themselves as one way. And I, you know, even from the day I started playing with that band, I never thought a religion should be tied to a music, a genre, or a band. I think once you put a phrase in front of a song or a band, be it Silverstein or be it Under Oath or be it Radiohead or Dave Matthews or whoever the hell you're talking about, I think. The minute you put rock or country or straight edge or Christian or vegan or Satanist or atheist or whatever you're putting in front of it, you've just defeated the whole purpose of music, which is supposed to be a universal language. It's supposed to be for everybody. And, you know, whether you're, you know, be it your taste of music or not, putting a category and then a genre, you've already turned off a lot of people.
Right. But you guys clearly understood that early on because you guys toured. You guys didn't exclusively tour with Christian bands, and like
we never toured with Christian bands.
No, and
yeah,
we used to see that all the time in that scene. That you know, the same Tooth and Nail bands would tour with the same Tooth and Nail bands all the time, and you guys never did that.
Yeah, it was just. I think that was a huge. You know, people grew up and change. I'm not saying that you grow out of religion or by any means, because. A lot of people are exactly the same, but I think for some people, life just has a different path for you, and I think that's okay.
Yeah.
And I think that's all in the understanding category of being an adult and being a human being and realizing, especially this day and age, you know, it's like expecting two people to be the same is just psychotic. It's like everyone's different. Everyone's path is different. Everyone deals with different things. We can relate on a lot of levels, but no two people are going to be the same.
Right.
Or they're going to feel exactly the same.
Well, so I guess you had that realization. I mean, you said when you guys actively decided to unlabel yourselves, whatever year that was. I mean, that was later on.
Yeah, I think it was 08.
But you must have had that realization too. Like back in 06, we were together when you guys dropped off the Warped Tour.
Right.
And that to me, I remember vividly that whole thing. And I remember, I'll tell a quick story. I remember one time I was walking, you know, like you would at Warped Tour, walking through, and I was carrying two beers. I had one beer in each of my hands. I don't know if you remember this. And I was just, you know, walking around. I don't remember going to watch a band or something. And I ran into you, and you were like, had this big smile on your face. And I was like, what's up, man? What's up, Spencer? You're like, dude, we just got our numbers. We sold like 100,000, like 90,000 or whatever. And we're like number two on the Billboard.
Yeah, 98,000.
And I was like, fuck, that's amazing, dude. I can't believe it. And then you were like, can I have a beer?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah. And I handed you a beer and we like sat and we drank a beer together. And I was like, I felt like that moment you guys realized that your popularity was like real. Because before that, like even though we had big crowds, both your band and our band, like on the Smart Punk stage in 04, and you know, we were selling out like places like the Auto Bar in Baltimore or whatever, like it didn't seem like it was real until boom, there it is, number two on the Billboard, 98,000 sold or whatever, like that can never be taken away. So how was that for you at that moment?
I remember I wasn't a big numbers guy. I was always I've been obviously a music fan my whole life. I think I remember calling my brother, my older brother, who I'm actually visiting right now, and being like, I'm pretty sure I know number two is huge. Like I knew that was like a huge deal, but wrapping my head around that, I was like, is that 98,000? I was like, is that mean just no one else big came out or released a big record, or is that a huge number? And he was like, dude, that's a huge number for 5 days. 'Cause technically it's 5 days of counting because they do, I don't know when it stops, but the first week of SoundScan is technically 5 days, I think. And he was just like, dude, that's insane. And that's when it kind of like connected in my brain. I was like, all right, my older brother, who obviously knows more than I do, is telling me this is insane. And I think that was, I remember sitting on the curb in the sun, blazing sun, like on the cell phone and hanging up in this. I'm normally the kind of person I pace on the phone, and I think I was pacing. And then when I hung up, I sat on the curb, which is very uncommon for me. I'm always moving around, and you know, I'm never really sitting still anywhere. And I just sat down on the curb by myself and just like kind of thought about it. I was like, this is weird. You know, I didn't even know what to think about. I was like, well, I guess that's what's happening. And I was really, really happy because I was really proud of the record that we did write, and that it was, you know, it was my favorite thing I'd ever been a part of yet. And I couldn't say that about the record before. I was indifferent. You know, there's things about it I liked. There's things about it I hated. And finally, I was happy with something that I had created. And
it was this massive success.
And it was a massive success. And I remember just sitting there going like, wow, like this might be the coolest thing that's ever happened in my life so far, you know?
Right.
And yeah, that
How crazy is that? And you have that realization. And
yeah.
And I mean, but at the same time, that kind of achievement can change people.
I think it does. I think success changes everyone, whether they like to admit it or not. And I think that could be anywhere from, you know, the most common is the big head ego guy who thinks, you know, he's the shit. And then there's the, you know, there's all the way to the opposite where the guy that goes reverse and like becomes a recluse and doesn't talk to anyone when, you know, like super overly humble and very uncomfortable, which happened to some of the guys. I saw both sides in our band.
Right.
I definitely saw the guy that thought he was the man, and I saw the guy that thought he didn't deserve anything and, you know, started wearing rags for clothes and trying to eat out of the dumpster and stuff. Like it was insane. I saw both sides, you know?
Yeah. Well, that really does go to what you were saying about finding your individuality as a band. you know?
Yeah.
So I guess when you guys had that blow up and left the tour in 06, that was probably the first realization of that.
Yeah, I think that was everyone dealing with their, because I think it was the splitting and the dealing with things were starting to happen. I know 2005 was a huge year of going around the world for the first time to a lot of places and starting to headline and selling things out and writing that record and going through. We were already going through some issues at the time, and early 06. You know, finishing the record and then touring still. And by the time Warped Tour came out, when it happened, we were already in completely different places. People were dealing with being different, and yeah. Everyone was different, you know, including myself, you know, like I went down an equally dark path as the other two guys that were going through totally different things. And I think we just got to a place, you know, where people were uncomfortable with each other. And it was like, well, you know, I'll never forget that either. You know, that was a very negative, awful conversation that probably shouldn't have gone the way that it did. But it was crazy. That was, if you can imagine having the best thing in your life happen to you, all right, well, we're done, you know, because that's what happened. That was, we were done. Or they were at least done with me at the time, you know, and that was like, all right, well, here we go. And that was extremely strange. And I think we made amends within a month and worked things out and talked. But it was, I don't think the understanding of each other happened until the breakup officially happened and people talk now like brothers. It's insane. It's 'cause like we started as brothers. Like, and I think within 2 years we weren't, and then we went, you know, 8 or 9 more years as not being, you know, on the same page.
It's totally nuts. I mean, I was talking to Adam from Taking Back Sunday just the other day, and it was the same thing with him and John, you know, they had a blow up and they didn't talk. And then it's like, now they're buying houses on the same street.
Yeah.
You know, and I want to talk about Taking Back Sunday later too, actually, because, you know, you probably know a few of their songs. But before we get into that, I want to ask you about you know, you mentioned They're Only Chasing Safety being kind of like, for you, there's parts of it, I mean, I'm putting words in your mouth a little bit, but parts of you that you would kind of take or leave.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole band, I mean, there's reasons why there's songs on that record we never played live, ever. I mean, this tour where we're doing both records back to back will be the first time we've ever played some of these songs live.
Right.
And there's still arguments on who has to sing which part, you know, because they're, you know, it's like, no, you're going to sing it. No, I don't want it. You're going to sing it, you know, because I mean, me and Aaron did a lot of that vocal stuff together. And, you know,
well, I want to ask you about that. I want to ask you about that because you came in the band and you replaced Dallas and, you know, I wouldn't say Under Oath, it was like, they weren't massively successful by any means, but they'd put out a record and they'd toured, you know, nationally.
Right.
And, you know, it was kind of like your job to come in and replace this guy. And correct me if I'm like way off base here, but like you come in the band and you're like, okay, and you know, you're a guy that's going to be doing the screaming. And all of a sudden it seems like Aaron wants to sing way more.
Yes.
Did that throw you off completely? Like throw you off your game or did that take you out of your element a little bit?
It was a little strange at first, and it was weird being, I'd never joined a band before.
Sure.
That wasn't my band already. And it was also strange because if you've heard of the Under Oath records go on and on and on, and I was a singer in a band before, I wasn't screaming. Well, okay. So the band I was in when they met me, I was screaming in because I was just a metal band, but the bands before that, I was just singing. And it was strange because I was like, well, we both can do this, but we did, and there's a lot of times it's both of us singing together, especially on Lost in the Sound of Separation. There's no one does two things of themselves. We did it like a live band would do it, and there's a lot of things we did. We sang the same thing together, or it's him and you think it's me, or it's me and you think it's him. Like there's a lot of that on all of the records, and we did work well together. The first one was a little strange. There's a couple songs I did by myself and wrote by myself, and a couple songs we did all together. And it was just strange. It was just kind of like testing the waters for me. It was just kind of like, I didn't know, you know, like they listened to things that I didn't listen to. We were all friends, you know, like me and Chris lived together before I was, you know, playing with them. And it was a strange making of that process.
I picture it in my head, like you came into the band and it was like, you know, you're the new guy. And like, I can just picture, you know, like, let me feel your heartbeat racing. Like you'd be like, well, am I supposed to sing that?
Yeah.
You know, and I always wondered
there was
because
times where it was interesting, but I talked to, I think about Greg, who's a good buddy of mine. He sings in Dillinger Escape Plan. And it's like, he joined that band. And then the first record they put out was with Mike Patton. You know, I was like, that's strange.
That
you
was
know,
so but weird. I remember that
sometimes,
happening.
Sometimes things, you know, it ended up working out great because if you fast forward, you know, 2 years into making To Find the Great Line, that was just like, all right, well, it's a completely different band at that point. Like it's completely different dynamic and it's got a lot more energy and a lot more, you know, I think I explain to people a lot because back then, and like, not like we're that old, but you know, in 2004, you would see a band and your experience might be different. So you can chime in. To me, you know, being from where I was from, you saw a band in the scene, especially you saw a band live before you heard the record.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
You would go to a show to see another band and you'd see one of the opening bands. Cause back then, unlike now, bands picked who they wanted to tour with and who they wanted to take on tour. Now it's all about money and numbers and social media and who your manager tells you to tour with, who your agent wants you to tour with, who your label wants you to bring out.
There's
you
know, a lot more of that for sure.
Yeah. Not a lot of these kids are picking the bands they want to bring. They're bringing the band who's going to fill out the venue or that their team is telling them to bring. Back in when we first started, it was different. So I know me being a concert goer before I was touring full time, I would see bands because I would go to see, you know, for example, being from North Carolina, I would go see Hope's Fall and end up seeing Every Time I Die, you know, and like, cool. And I'd go to the merch table and buy a CD and a shirt. And then I'd listen to Every Time I Die. I was like, cool, awesome. This band rules. I'm going to go see Every Time I Die. And then I'd go see Every Time I Die. And some other band was opening. And if I liked it, I was like, this is rad. And that's how I think it was back then. If you saw Under Oath live on their Only Chasing Safety, the energy and what was going on was a lot more like Defying the Great Line than it was their Only Chasing Safety. It was violent. Yes. It was a lot of energy. We were breaking stuff, jumping off stuff. It was a lot more violent than what the record sounded like. It was very polished off and very clean. And, you know, and that's not what the band ever sounded like live. So once the band actually took the direction that I felt like it was supposed to go in, and To Find the Great Line was written and recorded and put out, I was very happy.
Right.
Because it felt like we weren't trying to be something we weren't. And that's why I make that statement about Chasing Safety. Not that I am embarrassed of it or I hate it. You know, there's songs on there that I'm proud of and I do enjoy. I think it did a lot for our career. But I think the reason why that sounds like such a growing pain from Chasing Safety to To Find the Great Line and on, which was kind of a natural progression, is because I think it took us a minute to, you know, I came in when they asked me to join the band, I said no. And then they asked me again and I said no. I had heard the demos that they had with no vocals on it and I didn't like it. I thought it was too, I just didn't like it enough to be like, yeah, I'm going to quit the band I'm in. And then the band I'm in broke up and they asked me to record these two songs we recorded three songs. And we were going to play a show or two. I can't remember if it was one show or two shows.
Yeah.
And I think they were going to break up or change their name or do something different. And I was going to I was working on a new project anyway and whatever. And we got the first practice, we got in a room together and went over the old songs and then started writing immediately. And I think that was because we were all excited and it was, the energy was great. We were getting along. Me and Aaron were best friends and me and Chris were living together, you know, like, so it was natural. And then I think it wasn't natural until we realized, oh, the record sounds like this. And we're play like this. And we're on tour for a year. And we're like, all right, well, it just kind of naturally shaped into that Define the Great Line sound.
Hello, this is Tom Mullen from washedupemo.com. And on my podcast, I've interviewed the who's who of the emo post-hardcore scene to orally preserve that special time and place before the internet and Zuckerberg ruined our lives for good. Consider it your history lesson in all things emo. The podcast has been featured in iTunes, the Pitchfork Review, and the AV Club. To listen, go to iTunes.com/washedupemo. But don't even think about trademarking Emo Night.
But I mean, your voice, I mean, you have, I mean, I guess a part of it too is like a lot of people thought back in the They're Only Chasing Safety days, you weren't a singer. You could make, like, maybe even that you couldn't sing. It was Aaron does the clean vocals, Spencer does the screaming. And, you know, when you listen back to that record, and I put it on the other day because I knew we would be talking, and I still love that fucking record, man. But there, you actually sing on it a lot more than I kind of noticed.
Yeah.
Like, I hear your voice, and I'm like, oh, that isn't Aaron. That is Spencer. And then fast forward to the last record you guys did, it's amazing. Like, your vocals are amazing on it.
Thank
like,
you.
I couldn't believe it. Blew my mind when I heard it. And I wonder kind of how much of it is, was you just, like, you know, owning your craft over the better part of a decade, or how much of it was really, like, you could do it the whole time. You just felt like your place was to be the front man screaming.
I think a little bit of both. I mean, I definitely think if you listen to this singing part on They're Only Chasing Safety and you pop in my new band Sleepwave, which is 99.8% all singing,
right,
and you listen to the difference, there's definitely a huge improvement. I think, I mean, I've always been able to sing. I don't think any vocalist should start a band and can only scream. I don't think that's being a vocalist. I think that's probably not a wise idea. I think knowing how to sing before you can scream is very key. And I sang in bands, punk bands, thrash bands, you know, rock bands, you know, soft acoustic bands, pop punk bands. My whole life I was the singer. You know, they always pushed me out front to be the singer, even when I was little and, you know, it was like a little kid. It was always what they did because, like, even my first band with my brother and my cousin, wanted to be the guitar player and singer, and eventually I was the singer. You know, it's like, I was in choir as a kid and in chorus in school and my whole life. And I think when Underoath first started, I wasn't sure of myself or what, you know, I was very immature for my age. I was very, very far behind on, you know, how a 18-year-old should be acting. I was more like, I was like 13. And I think that when I was focusing at first just on being in a metal band, which was the band I was in before that, I wasn't singing all the time. And then I joined a band that was singing and screaming, and I wasn't too sure how to go back and forth all the time. And then before you know it, I'd figured it out and realized I started going to see a vocal coach in 2005. And I've, you know, Melissa Cross taught me a few things about myself and really helped me understand myself, and to where I haven't even gone for a lesson in, I mean, almost 8 years, but I still see her all the time. Every time I'm in New York, she comes out, we talk all the time. And she taught me how to take care of myself and what I was capable of. And if you, being a singer, you understand it's a muscle. The more you work out, like, you know, the new fad right now is to get buff and be in a band or something and work out in the gym all the time. Your voice is that gym that you should be paying attention to equally as well, because if you're singing scales and you're taking care of your voice and you're not going in cold to practice just singing or screaming, and you're not going cold into a show ever or a rehearsal or a recording. And, you know, normally I'll take a week or so off after a tour, unless I have another tour coming right up. Let's say I have a month off.
Yeah.
I'll take a week off. And then and then I start playing around. You know, I'm always playing. I play piano. I play guitar. I play everything but horns, basically. I'm always playing an instrument. I'm always kind of singing around in the shower, you know, walking around with the acoustic guitar, singing through my house or whatever. But then I start, at least a week before practice starts, I start doing my warm-ups every day because it's a muscle. It's just like if you stop working out, you stop bench pressing, and then you go in the gym and you bench whatever you benched last time you were there, you wake up the next day and you're going to be sore. And,
oh yeah, well, that's the two things that every musician knows is the bang. Well, the one thing is the bang over, which is like after the first show, the next day everyone's neck hurts like crazy from head banging. People like people that don't, you know, tour think it's hilarious, but it's a real thing. It kills.
It is a real thing.
And it's the same thing with a singer's voice, which is for me. I like to only do like three shows maybe, and then I need a day off, like the first week. you know,
which is ideal. I agree.
Like Soupy from the Wonder Years was telling me, he only does two to start.
Yes.
And that the whole reason is just because guys like me and him, we just don't warm up. Like we aren't in shape when we start a tour. And for me, it's tough just because like I live in an apartment. Like I guess I could belt it out here if I wanted to, but you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you a little bit about Melissa Cross, because I actually took two lessons with her. I think you might have told me about her, which is why I actually
probably I used to tell everyone about her. She's
yeah,
my girl,
I think that's what. Now that I'm thinking about it, I think that you were the ones got me in touch with her, and I thought she was like nice, and she taught me a lot about warm ups, but I didn't actually learn much about screaming.
No, not at all. I mean, she might work with screaming with other people, but I didn't even touch on that. We went in and she had seen me play a couple of times and she was like, well, you know, what do you want me to do with that? That's like, you've got that all figured out.
Oh,
you know?
Okay.
And I think with her, it's all the singing, because if you know how to sing and you're a singer before you're a screamer, I don't know how it works if you were the other way around when you started screaming in your first band and you're trying to learn how to sing. I don't even know how that works or why you would even think to do that. But
right.
For me, she was like, the more you strengthen your singing vocal cords, because a lot of singers can't scream, but if you're a singer and you can scream and she can work out so you can control your singing better, you're going to control your screaming even better. And that, I think I find that true to this day when, you know, I've been on tour all year and the few, you know, if I'm screaming at all, it's just like, this is cake, because I've been taking so much care of my, you know, doing all these warm-ups and singing all the time, that now it's become, because I know how to use that part of my voice, this is even easier because you've got more control, you've got more breath, you can pitch it better, you can control it better. It's
sure.
not just going up there and just going for it or hoping it's going to sound right or wondering what, I wanted it to sound like lower and then it came out in the middle or higher and it came out not high enough. You know, now you know it's like going to hit a note. You're not thinking about it, but you know where it is in your throat and you know what you're doing, you know. And I think screaming should be addressed the same way. It's all about control and understanding the instrument. And I think a lot of people don't know that, you know.
No,
and I think her approach is getting you comfortable as a vocalist and just teaching you how to strengthen your muscle and everything else just kind of falls in place. I'm sure if you asked her, you know, like how do I do this and how do I do that? She would help you, but I never did. I went to her just with an open mind and
yeah,
it's one of the best things I think I've ever invested in.
Well, she definitely
myself.
Gave me a sort of confidence, and some of the warmups that she gave me, I still do to this day. Like I still
you know, do.
And I think that she's awesome for that. So if anybody wants to sing like Spencer, go to melissacross.com. We'll give her a plug there. But I mean, with Sleepwave being, you said, 99.8% singing, have you been screaming at all since the last Under Oath show?
Yeah, I do. The band live, I'm the same way I was in Under Oath. I don't know, if you've ever seen Under Oath play live, you go see the record. But you'd always see all these things that weren't on any records, like these interludes and these jam things and these long drawn out things. And a lot of them would have vocals in them. And we'd write those. And I'm very particular about the way the set is going to flow.
Sure.
And with Sleepwave, I spend, you know, a couple weeks before the live band shows up, you know, working on, you know, the keyboards and the guitars of what's going to go in between the song. And then once the live band learns that stuff, I decide which parts are going to be a good part for me to take a breath and just let it be instrumental. What parts I'm going to add vocals to, and some of that stuff, depending on what tours we were on, because we did tour with a lot of heavy bands. We had some parts in the set that were just crazy heavy, you know, and with a lot of screaming and stuff, just because I know there's some Under Oath fans in the crowd and people are getting used to seeing me under a new thing. So I like to involve some things that, you know, it's not like we're going to get up there and cover an Under Oath song, but there's definitely parts where it's like, all right, the way this song ends, we can draw this out and we can make a moment out of this that's going to make some of the heavier fans more happy, you know, or just, it's going to be fun, you know, like let's do this cause it's going to be awesome. And on certain different tours, those definitely were heavier, screamier parts, because I don't think the record called for it as much as sometimes live it does, you know, sometimes you're just playing live and you're singing something and you I just want to scream. And then, you know, I call it the glass jaw. I think Daryl Palumbo is the key of how to sing and scream properly, because he'll sing, and you just like, as you're starting to feel the hair on your arm stand up, then he just lets out this scream, because I feel like one dude who captured passion very well was him on Worship and Tribute. Like, that's the, like, you're singing, it's getting more intense. You don't know what else to do. So you're just, rah, you know, and it just comes out, and it's so rad.
Well, he had an amazing mechanism where he could be singing a note and it would just sort of morph into a scream, like, seamlessly. Like, it wouldn't, I still don't really know how he ever did that, but
it's amazing. Whatever it is, it's awesome.
The only bad thing about him is how many assholes have tried to imitate him and totally sucked.
Yes. Agreed.
That is always the worst. There was like an era there for like 5 years where it seemed like every local band would be some terrible Glassjaw wannabe. It was the worst.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what's next with Sleepwave? You got this Under Oath thing, which will be taking up a lot of your time, and then you're going to be working on that again?
Yeah, so I've... it was funny because when I showed my manager where the new record's heading, he was seeing my schedule that I've had for the last year. He goes, "How in the hell did you have time to pull this off?" I'm just right. Like, you know, this is what I do, man. It's like, I can't stop writing music. So I'm about halfway done writing the record. I was just for the holidays and was moving into a new place, and the rest of this month I'm finishing writing blocks. I'm doing a block of writing now by myself, and then do a block of writing with Steven, who's the other guy in the band, in Florida next month around the Under Oath practice, because we start Under Oath practice, and most of the Under Oath practices are at night. So during the day, I'm going to be writing. And then
that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, I'm going to do a session. I'm going to do a writing block with drums involved. I have a drummer who has been with me for a while, and he plays live. He's not really in the band, but he tracked on all the demos, and I'm going to have him come down and kind of see where we land with some of these songs. So my goal is to be technically, if I'm around 15 to 20 songs, I feel like I'm pretty ready for a record. And I normally write some songs while I'm in the studio as well. My goal is to, you know, I'll be focused on Under Oath come, you know, most of February and all of March and April, and hopefully May or June enter the studio with Sleepwave and make the second record and start touring, you know, immediately after that. You know, it's not like I'm doing one thing at a time ever anyway. So.
Yeah, I know. And trust me, now I'm working on a solo thing myself, and this podcast is taking up way more time than I thought it would. Not to mention Silverstein, we never slow down. So I'm a busy guy, so I can relate to that.
Yeah,
based on what you were saying with the playing live with Sleepwave and being like, oh shit, like I feel this scream. I can incorporate that. Can people expect the new Sleepwave stuff to be maybe a little bit heavier?
From what I've demoed out so far, I think it's more broad. So I think Broken Compass sound, if you see the band live, I compare it a lot to, cause a lot of kids will come up and be like, man, I had no idea. This is fucking unreal. You know, like, I think it's like very, very Chasing Safety. I think Chasing Safety did not really sound, it never sounded anything close to what we sounded like live, and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. And I think Sleepwave sounds like the record, but there's a lot more grit, and it's dirtier, it's grungier, and at times it's heavier, and at times it's softer. And I think that is an example of me not being there for the mix, which I was kind of unhappy with, and it got very cleaned up. All the guitars were dirtier when I left, you know, and you know, it wasn't, I think, you know, maybe the label and the mixer cleaned it up a little bit when we were on tour, and that stuff happens all the time. And I'm still very proud of the record, but it's definitely, if you've seen it live, and a lot of people have, because I've been on tour for the last year, if you've seen it live, you can expect more of what it's like live. There's a lot of those, you know, there, it's just like Under Oath. There's stuff, tons of stuff I'm playing live that's not on the record. And the new stuff is it's way more broad. Like at times it's poppier and softer and more piano based. And then there's times where the heaviest parts that have happened on some newer songs, you know, and it's, It's cool because now that Under Oath is back, people understand what I'm up to, I think. I think it was hard for people to understand, why would you abandon metal and hardcore and the scene and this, that, and the other? And I'm, you know, if anyone that has ever met me knows that I'm a musician, I'm you know, like for the people, like you said, when you first heard Under Oath, I was just a guy screaming, or the guy screaming and singing in a metal band. I must be the metal guy because I'm the front man of this right. hardcore band. And most of the people that met me understood that I wasn't. I do love that music, but I was also, you know, I was at 18. My first tattoo was like a Radiohead tattoo, and I loved Coldplay and the Beatles and Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones. And I also loved Alice in Chains and Nirvana and the Deftones. And at the same time, I loved Poison the Well and Hope's Fall and Meshuggah. And you know, like, I mm-hmm. I'm a music lover. I love music. So Sleepaway is a thing of for me to not just play metal for another 10 years. I was so excited to be in a rock band. Like, this is great. I can focus on songwriting. You know, like right. the first thing that my dad taught me was the Beatles, and that was very song oriented. And that, I always feel like Kurt Cobain took the Beatles approach and spiced it up with aggression. And I thought that was genius. That was like my favorite band as a kid. That was everything to me, you know, and I just wanted to do something that was more based on melody in the song and less on the riff. Cause being a guitar player, me and Tim writing riffs after riff, after riff, after riff, I was sick of writing riffs. I wanted to write some songs, you know?
And I totally get it, man. But I mean, the other thing is, like, it's way more of a challenge for you to start something like Sleepwave, which is a little bit out of left field for the casual Under Oath fans, because if you just started another screaming hardcore band, it would be way easier for people to understand.
I could have been on every heavy tour, you know, selling a lot of merch and, you know, doing, it would have been easy.
It would have been easy.
I think now that Under Oath is back together, it's easier for a fan to understand what I'm up to. Cause it's like, now what? So if I started Under Oath Part 2, with another group of guys, which I never wanted to do. I said, if I ever play heavy music again, it's going to be with those guys. I said that in an interview before, yep. like as the band was breaking up. And I meant that. I wasn't just hinting at Sleepwave as being different. I meant that with all my heart. I couldn't fathom taking the easy way out. And now that that's an option, now that kids are realizing that Under Oath is a band, and whether that means a new record or just some tours here and there or both or whatever, it's way easier to understand. It's like, because what would happen now if I just had Under Oath Part 2 and now Under Oath 1 is back? Now I'm just an idiot, you know? Like,
I haven't thought about that. That's a very interesting observation.
And now it's kind of like, you know, you can see me do two different things if you'd like. And if you only like one, that's up to you too as well. And I don't really care. You know, it's for me as a musician, it's freedom. And I think that's why people start playing music, is because they want to create something that's themselves. And to create a metal band again wouldn't have been myself, because by myself, that's not how I feel. And, you know, with those guys, that's how it came out and it made sense. But to force that just myself wouldn't have been right, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So you keep saying Under Oath is back. So is Under Oath back?
I think, in my head, I think the conversation we've had is like, we lifted the hiatus, whether that, you know, that means what Incubus did, and they did one tour every 2 years and then made an EP and put it out and then made a record, or what The Refuse did, which was play a couple of shows after they did their, when they got back together, then what did it take them 2 years? And then they just put out a record. What was it, this year or 2015?
Yeah.
Now they're back. I can confirm that there's been no music written. There hasn't even been a practice yet. But I can also say that we definitely, that's not off the table, you know.
Yeah.
Me, Tim, and Aaron being the guys that do a majority of the writing have spoken about just questioning each other. Like, I hope your mind is, my mind is open. And if it makes sense and it's natural for all of us over the next couple of years of now that we're a band again, because we are a band again, that means we're getting in rooms together and playing music. We're getting on flights together. We're getting in a bus together. We're going to be on stage together again. Knowing the three of us, stuff is going to come out, whether we release it or not, I don't know. And I just think the only conversation I've had with those dudes about seriously thinking about another record is, if it's not better than the first time you heard Define the Great Line, like the blow that that hit you in the face with was like, wow, then it's not worth releasing, because it's got to be the best thing we've ever done by 10,000 miles, or start over and try again. And if that takes us a year, that takes us 10 years, right, or if we never even worry about it because we're too busy doing other things, those are all options. And well, I don't really know.
The one
I
thing,
do know that ahead. I'm open, you know, I'm open to writing music with my friends, whether that means we're going to write a record or not, who knows, but I've definitely been open to it. And I don't think it's going to be right away. You know, it's obviously would take a long time, especially with everyone's schedule. And, you know, Aaron's in Paramore, I'm in Sleepwave, Tim has a full-time job, and so on and so forth, you know.
Sure. No, I totally get those obstacles. But, I mean, the one thing about Under Oath is, I mean, you guys have never phoned it in. I mean, whether it's been a tour, a show, a festival, or, of course, any of the records you've done. And they've always been fantastic, and they've always been next level, I feel. Like, they've always been exceeded expectations, you know, every step of the way. So
I agree.
I think it's awesome you guys are getting back together. When you guys are in Toronto, I will be there.
Awesome. What's really sad about Toronto to me, being a huge great market for us and a lot of bands, is they tore down the Cool House. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, it's gone.
And when we booked the tour, I remember, because Toronto was a huge conversation because it's the only Canadian show on the tour. And I was like, well, it's got to be at least the Sound Academy, if not bigger, because that's where we did our farewell show that sold out super fast. And the Sound Academy is going to be closed for 6 months during the time.
Oh, I didn't know that.
They're going to be reconstructing. So we're playing some venue that's way too small. I don't know what the venue is. And I know
it's the Phoenix. It was a real head scratcher when I saw it too.
That's the only venue.
It's a 1200 cap room, and it's not my favorite.
It's the only venue that was available, and be it, like I told a lot of people, this tour happened because everyone, all those guys have jobs, they all got off their work. There was no way to move around stuff.
Yeah.
There was no way to add second dates. We could have added second dates to all these shows.
I know.
And I was really upset about Toronto because I saw that, and our agent was just like, it's either we play there or we don't play Toronto at all, because Sound Academy is going to be doing 3 months of reconstruction during the time. And they bulldozed Cool House, and that's really our only option.
Yeah, there's Danforth Music Hall, but yeah, I mean they have like 25 shows a month, I think. So it might have been booked at the time. That's a pretty good venue. That's kind of a newer one that's popping up now. We played there at Christmas.
Yeah, it's a bummer, but we'll make the best of it. And you know, I was a little upset about, there was two shows on the tour that we had to make exception, like we had to just take who was available, and one being Charlotte, which is my stomping grounds, and Adam from Taking Back Sunday. We were North Carolina boys, and I was upset about that. And I love Toronto, and I was upset about that. But
where
you
playing in Charlotte?
Charlotte, we're playing Amos South, and because it was I don't know, it's a big business thing where Live Nation and AG compete over certain things, and we're not allowed to play the Fillmore because we did all these shows with someone else that wasn't with this person that has that venue, and it's all about politics, you know. But those two, but that was, if we would have gone the other way with the other company, I'm not saying which company we went through, if we would have gone the other way, there was more venues we would have had to compromise with, and so the only two of the shows, or the two compromises, were Toronto, and that was just primarily because the city didn't offer a better venue at that time in the year, and then Charlotte. But
well, it doesn't matter. Okay. The tour is going to be off the chain.
Oh,
and,
it's going to be so fun. And you know what?
I kind of like Amos. I kind of like that place in Charlotte.
Kids
anyways.
Actually like smaller venues better, and I'm okay with that. I just don't like the production planned. If the stage and the ceiling of the stage doesn't admit for the production, I always feel bad.
The Phoenix has one of the smallest stages ever.
Yeah, so I always feel bad for people that paid the same amount of money as the people before, but the people the night before got LED walls and projection screens and all these lights, and then the next night people pay the same price, and just because it's a smaller venue, they don't get all that stuff. And I think that's always a bummer. Yeah. As a musician on the stage, being like, man, I feel bad because I wish these kids could have seen the whole thing, but can't win them all, you know?
Yeah. So speaking of LED walls, how was the filling in for Taking Back Sunday? How did that come about?
Well, that was crazy. We, you know, Under Oath and Taking Back Sunday have done tons of tours together. We're all good friends. Me and Adam are actually both from North Carolina. We knew each other before he was Adam of Taking Back Sunday and I was Spencer of Under Oath. We were both playing in little bands together.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that.
We weren't in the same band together, but we were playing shows together all the time throughout high school around the Greensboro, Winston-Salem, High Point area.
Yep.
He ended up moving to New York 2 years or a year before I moved to Florida. He's a little older than I am. And I could honestly say Adam is one of my longest running friends as far as since I was that young, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't really talk to a lot of people from when I was that young or no one. Adam's probably the longest friend I've had. Whether we get to see each other a lot or not, you know, we still keep in touch a lot. We talk a lot. I see him for Christmas a lot. But it was a situation where Under Oath had broken up and it was crazy. I was in a really, really depressive state and pretty upset and still hadn't gotten over it yet. I think I was still angry and it was 9 months, which is the longest I'd ever been since being on stage. Cause even as a kid, even in when you're in a local band, you played at the very least once a month, at the very, very, very least since I was 12 years old. And this had been 9 months since I had been on stage, the first time in my life, you know, since I'd started being on stage.
Yeah.
And I just was losing it. I didn't know what was going to happen. And I get a very sad phone call because Adam is saying that he needs to go home because his wife is, you know, there's stuff going on in the pregnancy. They didn't know what was going to happen. And it was a...
There were complications, yeah.
There was complications, and he needed to be there. No one knew what was going to happen. It was very scary.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, everything turned out to be okay. She's absolutely fine, and the baby's beautiful and fine and really awesome. But they didn't know, so Adam needed to go home. And they were halfway through a headlining tour. And for the listeners that don't know what that means you've rented a bus, you have a crew, you have opening bands, you have lights, you possibly have a truck, you have printed merch. And most bands that, you know, you budget, you know, kind of give or take, you know, you've budgeted that in your year of your salary of kind of like, okay, this is how I'm going to get by. And it's all been budgeted in there. You know, like you're counting on this. And these guys have families and kids. There is no way they can cancel the rest of this tour because half of a headlining tour, you're going to lose more than what you would have just done if like you booked only 14, you know, 20 shows.
Yeah.
Because of all the rental and all the money having to give back, the venues have already been rented out. The security guards have already been hired. The tickets have been sold.
Oh yeah, it would have been a massive headache to try to cancel.
Dude, it would have been. It's a nightmare if you have to cancel a tour.
So they called you.
So they call. Adam was basically like, "You're the only guy I can trust. I trust that can do this as a friend. You know, as a friend, and he knows how my singing voice is like. And he is one of the guys that was getting all the Sleepwave demos. Like I would write a song and record it and send it to. Like he heard the early demos from that record before Under Oath was even broken up. He's heard half these songs. He's heard what I'm doing with my voice and what I'm up to. And, you know, and he's seen me play live a million times and vice versa and been on tour together forever. So he's just like, there was no question in my mind. There wasn't a, how much will I get paid? How will I get there? How many songs? What am I supposed to do? Like, it was just like, I need your help as a friend and as a fellow musician. And I didn't even think. I just was like, absolutely. So then it's like a manager to manager thing of 18 songs and 36 hours and a flight. And it kind of set in. I was like, oh shit. I know I'm familiar with these songs, but I definitely don't know all the lyrics by heart. And definitely don't know if it's John singing, if it's Adam singing, if it was, Fred, like, it was like, oh God. So I get my, playlist together of just all the songs they're playing in the set. And I literally stayed up all night. And at the time I was living in an apartment and I remember my neighbor banging on the door. And I was like, I had my in-ears in, so I couldn't hear anything.
I was
singing along full voice, reading the lyrics on every single song for the entire time. I didn't sleep until we traveled to the first show. And then I got on the, you know, we played the first show with a flyout and then we flew back to the bus and I was there for, I want to say it was like 2 weeks at least of shows. And
Oh, you did 2 weeks of shows? I didn't know it was that many.
It was a lot. Yeah, we didn't know. It was a good. It was more than 10, I want to say, and it was. I want to say it was 2 weeks I was there.
How many shows until you felt like at all confident?
One.
That's pretty good.
What I did was on the set list, because we're all on in here, so we didn't use monitors, but I left my monitor up front. And on the set list, instead of printing it out on one page, I have their tech printed out on two pages. And what we do is just write the first two lines of the song underneath the song title. Because for me, once I hear, okay, you know, once I like know the first line, I would remember the whole thing.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It was just how my mind works. It was like, I wasn't completely familiar with, you know, every song title. And by the end, I didn't even have that up there anymore. But there was the first couple shows I had that like kind of a cheat sheet almost to where I could look down and be like, all right, this song, Set Your Face to Stone, it starts. And I would like read the first line as they're like ringing out before the song started. I'm like, all right, I got it. And then I would just run up front and like, just go. Yeah. You know, and
dude, I picture myself trying to learn 18 songs in 36 hours, and I would be like, dude, just get me a teleprompter.
Yeah, it was so fun, and it was great to be back on stage, and it was great to help out my friends. I love those dudes. Every guy in that band has never been anything but completely amazing and nice to me. You know, I've spent a lot of time in my life with Adam and a lot of time with Mark. I used to spend a lot of off time on tour with one or the other or both of those guys. We were just really tight, and to be able to help them and to help Adam and to have fun. I had a blast doing it. Like,
yeah, it sounds like something that you needed like at that time in your life.
Oh, at that time in my life, you know, it was great. It was a good wake up call to like, you know, get my life together and be like, all right, I gotta learn to forgive and forget and kind of move on and focus harder and, you know, realize that its life isn't that all that bad. And it was great, man. Like I would do it again. And the funny thing is there was a time before to where Fred went home. Fred was on a couple of the records who did the guitar and the second vocals.
No, I know
vocals.
Fred really well. Yeah.
Yeah. And he went home on a European tour. Justin from Seosin played the guitar. And a couple of songs, I'd come out and sing all of Fred's parts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so we had kind of done that together, and that was me and Adam on the stage at the same time. And then we did that. The show that Adam came back, we did that. I came out for like two or three songs, and we did like two, you know, dual vocals together. And I was like, it was fun thing. Yeah,
that's cool. Yeah, yeah. Awesome, man. Well, hey, that's a good experience for you at that time, and. Now, man, you're going to have a crazy 2016. Did you make any New Year's resolutions?
No.
I don't think you have to. You're not going to have any time to worry about that shit.
Yeah, I think...
Way too busy.
Trying to enjoy life a little bit more. And, you know, it's crazy because, you know, there's times where I can look back on pictures and go, man, I don't even... I did have issues with substance, but like I never did anything before shows, and I never even drank even to this day. And I'm a drinker, and I have been since I was 21, but there's still times where I'll look back on things and not remember because you're that busy and it's off to the next place, off to the next place. And there's certain things that Underoath did that I look at pictures of, and I'm like, man, that's insane. We did that. I don't even remember that. That's like the biggest crowd you'll ever see, or like, you know, like playing.
It's amazing
arenas.
Your perception. How much, you know, when you think about something, like the funniest thing too for me is I agree with you. Like some of the festivals we played, you know, where there was like 80,000 people watching, and I like see a picture and I'm like, I can't believe how many people are there in that picture. It's like way more than I remember. But then by the same thing, I remember the first time we ever went to California, we played a show at the Showcase Theater in Corona, California, and we're like, yeah, we're here, we're in Southern California for the first time. And in my head there was like 500 people in this room, and it was like insane. And I saw a picture of it, there was like maybe 30 people.
Yeah. Exactly.
So it's funny how the perception can work both ways.
Yeah, it definitely can. That's absolutely true. I remember the first year of touring with Underoath in 03 when I joined, I remember the perception of the band being like, wow, this band, you know, they have a music video and they're, you know, and,
oh, yeah, yeah.
And they've toured nationally before. They'd done a couple of tours or whatever. And I remember joining the band, like the Florida show was sick and Alabama was cool and Atlanta was okay. And then all of a sudden it was like, wow, this is exactly like the band I was touring in. There's no one showing up. These are shows are tiny. You know, because it's funny how perception works. And I think in this day and age, this is a completely different subject. I think that's one of my kind of weird thoughts about Warped Tour is some of these bands to the kids get this perception of this huge band. And I think some of the band members get a perception of that they're huge too, which causes some, you know, some problems and kids feel really disconnected that this is massive band. It's like, no, Warped Tour is a, you know, there's a lot of people that come because it's Warped Tour and you're just playing in front of a ton of people because you got a good spot that day. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean that every band on the tour draws 10,000 kids, you know?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right, man.
It goes tons of different ways. You know, I don't know. I remember some of the bands being bigger or smaller than they were. Like when we toured with the Used doing arenas, like that was.
Oh,
like,
I remember that. Yeah. You guys played Arrow Hall in,
yeah, it was like,
yeah,
literally,
yeah,
insane. Toronto, yeah. And when we did the Used Taste of Chaos thing was insane as well. And Austin Ting Mek Sunday did an arena tour and these arenas are like, you know, full on hockey arenas. And then Sleepwave played with Bring Me the Horizon at Wembley Arena. And like, you're just like, as not being the main act or one of the main acts opening it, I'm looking at like, wow, this is incredible. But like as Under Oath has played venues bigger than that. And I never, you know, I was always obviously very thankful, but that doesn't go through your head of like, this is crazy. This band is this big, you know? And it's like, we've done many shows that big, but as Sleepwave, it was like obviously a great opportunity. But yeah. It's just funny how you see things differently as an opening band, a direct support band, or a headlining band. It's completely different. Like
that's right. Yeah.
It's wild in the way that your brain can work and put you in different, you know, I don't know, just different situations make you look at things completely different.
Well, I guess one last question. I mean, you got any regrets about the way it all went down with Under Oath? Do you think like starting Sleepwave before Under Oath kind of finished, do you think that contributed to the breakup or anything else? No,
I don't think so at all. I mean, I was writing, I have three or four songs on a hard drive that I was writing after Disambiguation. I had like programmed some drums and written some guitar riffs. And that was like mid writing Under Oath when I found out that they wanted to stop. I guess my regret is having no clue that we were about to break up. Like we had felt that way, but it'd never been real. You know, like
you felt a bit blindsided.
I felt a little bit, not completely, but I felt, I just never thought it was the right time. I didn't think it was fair to do as little farewell shows as we did. Still to this day, I think even if we did a full U.S. farewell tour, the reunion rebirth tour would be just as awesome and just as full and sold out as it would have been otherwise.
Absolutely.
I think
you're
that
right.
that was sad to me because people were so good to that band and so awesome that it was really hard for me as someone that appreciated the diehard fans as much as I did and as much the whole band did. And I don't think anyone did it for bad reasons. I knew they just didn't want to do it anymore. And I don't want to force anyone to be up there, but we were having fun on that farewell tour. And I think if it would have just been booked all in all, we wouldn't have talked about it beforehand. Our manager or someone was just like, no, you're doing a full tour like Amberlin did or whoever after us, you know, like that would have been, that's my regret. You can see that very clearly on the DVD, how I was mad about the breakup and I was mad about not doing a full tour. So I guess I got what I wanted.
Here we go. You got what you wanted. It took a few years.
The band's back together.
But you're back. And man, I'll let you go. But hey, thank you so much for being on my podcast. And I hope we can do it again, sometime down the road.
Yeah, let's try to link up again around the second Sleepwave record and talk about that. coming out.
I would absolutely. I can't wait to hear it. And I know when I listen to it, I'm going to think about this conversation and
heck yeah,
you know, hear those songs. So that's awesome, Spencer. Well, thanks again. And I got a New Year's resolution for you. Maybe you should start being on time for things.
Dude, good talking to you, man.
I'm an asshole. Good talking to you, man.
Are you playing either one of those festivals we're doing?
Oh yeah, we're doing the So What? Yeah,
okay,
I can't
cool.
believe we didn't even talk about that. Yeah, I'll see you in Dallas.
I'll see you there, and we'll keep talking.
Absolutely, man. All right.
Take care. Yep. See ya.
Take care. So we did show up after all, and that was a great conversation. It really was amazing to me how after pretty much, I mean, what, almost a 15-year career, Under Oath just decided, boom, 12 shows, we're done. You know, no farewell tour. You know, not going back to Europe, anything like that. And they just decided to end it. And obviously, if you watch that DVD, Tired Violence, which you definitely should check out, it's beautifully shot. It really gives a great emotional insight into what they went through as a band. And you can tell Spencer definitely didn't want the band to end. All right, I've dubbed this in later. It's midnight on February 1st. I have gone 1 month without drinking. Yes, congratulations to me. So on that note, here we go. It's time. Oh, once it hits your lips, just so good. Hey, we'll see you next week. Aaron from Under Oath will be here. I'm going to leave you with a classic song as I'm drinking this beer, Goose Island IPA. Not that great, but whatever. It never gets old, catchy as hell. Here it is, Reinventing Your Exit on Lead Singer Syndrome.